You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, September 13th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Lindsey Graham announces a federal abortion ban proposal. Meanwhile, the DOJ issues 40 subpoenas in a week in its January 6th investigation. Also on the program, massive railway strike looms with Friday as its deadline. The Senate will hold hearings over allegations that Trump pressured the DOJ to pursue his critics. Also on the program, inflation tops forecasts as rent, food, and medical care drives a 0.06 price growth. Day two of the largest private sector nurses strike ever. 15,000 on strike in Minnesota. Biden gets a big approval bounce from young voters, and Democrats close the enthusiasm gap. Meanwhile, it's primary day in New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Delaware. And fighting breaks out across the Armenian and Azerbaijan border. And then lastly, I think in our fun half, we will have Mike Duncan. He is the host of the Revolutions podcast and author of Hero of Two Worlds, The Marquis de Lafayette in the Age of Revolution. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Tuesday, and to put that into context, our co-host, Emma Vigeland, is back.
I am.
Ta-da.
Hi. What'd that do?
Well, I guess somebody's a little rusty.
Eesh.
There we go.
A little bit. Yes. It is Newsday, Tuesday.
Thank you very much.
How are you?
Well, how was your time?
It was good. I was at my cousin's wedding. We're very close. It was out in the it was a backyard wedding out in the San Francisco area, and the heat had gone down like just on Saturday, so it was scorching out there. I heard earlier in the week it was up to 120. So up in that area, that is like a completely unheard of for the most part. So I don't know, the planet's burning up, but we had a nice party in the meantime.
All right, well, yeah. There you go. Well, that sounds like fun. Newsday Tuesday.
Yeah.
All right, well, we got a lot to talk about on the program today. We're going to get, obviously, to the Lindsey Graham thing. And there's also, I want to talk about this. I've gotten a couple of emails about it, and I've been sort of following it. We're going to have a guest on, but I'll give a slight overview of a case that the Supreme Court has accepted and is going to be adjudicating that could also be incredibly problematic. One that I was not familiar with, but, you know, over the past couple of years, I've been talking about their assault on the administrative state, but this one fits that bill. But first, let's go to this. The Senate has the Democrats in the Senate have announced that they will hold hearings based on allegations that came out of former U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Berman's new book. And here is Rachel Maddow interviewing this guy. I mentioned this yesterday. Back in 2005, I believe it was, maybe it was in 2004, the Bush administration was looking for, and again, this is important because Donald Trump did not drop out of the sky. There's nothing that Donald Trump has been talking about that the groundwork wasn't already laid by prior by the Republican Party. In 2004, the Bush administration was trying to restrict voting. They wanted to have across the country voter ID laws. They wanted to limit the number of voting polling places. They wanted to, all the things that the Republicans are successfully doing now, the Bush administration and the Republicans were pushing at the time. They needed a predicate for it. And that would be the voting fraud. But they could not find any voting fraud, and they began to pressure U.S. attorneys around the country. Remember, the Department of Justice has subsidiary U.S. attorneys, essentially, all around the country, multiple ones in some states. And they kept pressuring these to find voter fraud cases, and most of them couldn't. And to actually pursue other sort of politically motivated cases. Chris Christie was one of those guys who did the bidding of the Bush administration. Others didn't and were fired. And so the Republican Party has been in the business of corrupting the DOJ for a long time. So this is not just a Trump thing. The difference is that back in the day, the Republican Party would do it for sort of like a broader agenda than just somebody who was criticizing George Bush. That's the only difference. Here is Jeffrey Berman on Rachel Maddow's show.
You do say towards the very end of the book something that has that resonates very loudly. You say that you believe the reason you were forced out was based in politics. The timing 5 months before the election was not an accident.
Pause it. We should just be clear that if people don't recall this story, Berman was asked to resign by Bill Barr about 5-6 months outside of the election. He refused, and so Barr fired him.
You mean freedom fighter Bill Barr?
Freedom fighter Bill Barr. He who is just the hero of the resistance now.
Him and Mike Pence.
It resonates very loudly. You say that you believe the reason you were forced out was based in politics. The timing 5 months before the election was not an accident. And you say that you believe Barr forced you out of that job at SDNY because he no doubt believed that by removing me, he could eliminate a threat to Trump's reelection. How was your work as U.S. attorney a threat to Trump's reelection?
Well, at the time I was fired, the Southern District of New York was working on a couple politically sensitive cases. One of those cases is the Steve Bannon We Build the Wall case. And we were very close to indicting that case around the time I got fired, and Barr knew about the case. And as you know, that case was indicted by the Southern District of New York by Audrey Strauss, who took over as acting U.S. attorney after I was fired. And she brought that prosecution. And then, President Trump pardoned Steve Bannon, which was an outrageous pardon. But that's one of the cases that we were investigating, and we were very close to indicting. And the other case was the Ukraine investigations arising out of the Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman indictments. And that was something that we had been investigating for quite a while, and we continued to investigate for quite a while. And both of them were very sensitive.
There's even more that they were looking at. And so now the Senate is going to basically hold hearings around this. And again, Republicans have done this in the past, but the difference is that generally it's not so narrowly tailored to help just one person.
Yeah, he made a lot of allegations in that book, right? And wasn't there also something about this an attempted investigation into John Kerry?
Yes, there is. At one point, department officials, according to Berman, pressured the Southern District. And again, And I'm sure you know this, Emma, too. The Southern District of New York has always been considered the most independent, politically sort of like insulated U.S. Attorney's Office in the country.
And if you're going for a big case, the Southern District is going to take it up. It's in Lower Manhattan.
They had pressured the Southern District to prosecute the former Secretary of State, John Kerry. Berman's office investigated. They declined to bring charges. The department then sent the matter to another U.S. attorney's office, which also declined to prosecute. So they were shopping this thing around. They also, according to Berman, he says that Barr, after taking office in 2019, suggested that the conviction of Michael Cohen, you'll recall, was Trump's former lawyer, for violating campaign finance laws, be reversed. Barr also sought to stop related investigations into campaign finance violations, broadly speaking. Berman writes that in September 2018, a department official called Berman's deputy 2 months before the November midterms after citing the recent prosecutions of two prominent Trump loyalists. The official said the office, which had been investigating Gregory B. Craig, a powerful Democratic lawyer, should charge him and do so by Election Day. This is the quote, according to Berman, that Edward O'Callaghan, the principal associate deputy attorney general, said, "It's time for you guys to even things out." Which, incidentally, is generally how we don't operate law enforcement.
Like a makeup call from the refs.
Berman's office declined to prosecute Craig. The department sent the investigation again. They shopped around to federal prosecutors in Washington, where presumably they had more influence. Craig was indicted and tried on a single count of making false statements. He was acquitted by a jury in less than 5 hours. And this is important to keep in mind, because when you hear people decry, and some of these people maybe you take seriously, others you don't, the authoritarianism, the vague authoritarianism that is coming out of the Biden administration, the idea that they are, and we'll hear this from Hannity, we'll hear it from Greenwald, I don't know that there's a difference at this point, that these investigations into Trump are politically motivated. I mean, they're all over the place. The investigation into Trump about stealing U.S. government documents, they tried for months and months to avoid getting to a position where they'd have to prosecute the guy. They just give us the documents back. They're not yours. I mean, I think there's an argument, a legitimate argument, that I don't know how you call it, the Biden administration, that the National Archives, that the DOJ, that the FBI was so tentative in going after these documents that they could have, that delay could have caused a major, or may have, well, for all we know, national security risk. This dude's just hanging on to these incredibly sensitive documents.
And then when he and his lawyers returned them, they were light because he was clearly trying to hang on to them for all he could.
I think these are the special ones. I'm so sentimental about these.
I mean, they're just so close to my heart. And like, so Bill Barr does all this. He was the replacement for the guy that loved Trump more than anything. The Alabama,
Jeff Sessions. Yes, his heart was broken.
Yeah, his heart was broken when Trump stabbed him in the back. But like, just think, and of course we've had attorney generals under Republican administrations that abuse their power wildly, like Gonzales or Ashcroft or whatever. But like, if Trump gets back into office now,
yeah, go ahead.
that sound drop would have been perfect, yeah, if the board was working.
Only God, no other king. Let the mighty.
Okay, go.
It's just obligatory. But so say a Republican gets in office. 2024, 2028, who's the next guy that's going to come down?
Of course. I mean, this is par for course in the way they operate. It's par for course. And this investigation needs to happen. And frankly, they need to go back and investigate, as far as I'm concerned, what happened in 2004, 2005.
And it needs to happen because of the accountability that we're talking about here. Because, as we say, the Republican administrations have been trying to do this and steadily making gains on this for years. And the morons who are saying, like, oh, but if the investigation in and of itself could cause such blowback with Trump supporters and such violence that it's not worth doing it all together. No, this is the exact reason why you need to do it, because you need to hold these people accountable so that tides can turn on this front and Republican administrations understand that this can't happen.
We got one sponsor today, and that sponsor is Emmy Ramen Noodles. Here's what makes Emmy special, okay? I think probably everybody loves ramen noodles, instant ramen noodles, but they're delicious. These are particularly delicious. And I had no idea, because, frankly, I don't read the packaging on the things that much, and I probably should. But Emmy's delicious, but here's the real kicker. Each serving of Emmy ramen noodles has only 6 net carbs and is packed with 21 grams of protein. For folks who watch what they eat, you know that keeps you feeling fuller for longer. Emmy is 100% plant-based. It is also dairy-free. It also has 18 grams of fiber. That's up to four times more fiber than most other instant ramen brands. And unlike other instant ramens, which are high in sodium and preservatives, Emmy has up to 35% less sodium than its competitors. So you don't get that post-ramen bloat. I mean, frankly, it's just healthier for you. It's super easy to prepare in the microwave or on a stovetop. You can have a bowl of Emmy ready in 7 minutes. Comes in delicious, comforting plant-based flavors like spicy beef, tom yum shrimp, or as I say in Thai, tom yum kung.
Oh, you're very cultured. I like that beef one that I had.
The spicy beef is great. The shrimp is also great. And frankly, the black garlic chicken also great.
Oh, I love anything with garlic in it, I'm down.
And I have to say, I mean, they don't mention this. I mean, I find it delicious. But for me, it is like the one thing that I can get Myla to cook for herself. She has the ability to cook some stuff, but, 17.
She's 17. That was when I went through my ramen phase, too.
Oh, my gosh.
She'll graduate.
But the upshot is I am not bringing home a bag full of sodium for her to eat. So she loves it. It's delicious. I love it. It's delicious. But it's also healthy and plant-based. Emmy's giving my audience $5 off when you go to emmyeats.com/majority report and use the code majority report at checkout. That's Emmy Eats, emmyeats.com/majority report. Use the code majority report, all one word, for $5 off. The link is in the YouTube and the podcast description. Check it out. You will definitely enjoy yourself. And be a little bit healthier. There you go. All right, let's just touch on this too. Friday is a deadline for a massive railway strike in this country. It is the end of the 30-day cooling off period, federally mandated cooling off period. Biden made that declaration 28 days ago, 27 days ago. I can't do the math. We're talking about 150,000 or so, I think, railway workers. It will impact Amtrak insofar as Amtrak rides on those same rails. And so, Amtrak will still have service, but it will be greatly diminished because there won't be necessarily the same sort of workers working those rails. There are two unions that represent the majority of workers. There were multiple unions, I guess, that about a dozen unions that were involved in this. And 10 of them I think, basically had come to a deal, but they will join these other two unions going on strike.
And that, oh, they're going to join them because that two union, it seems so.
Well, they have the vast majority anyways.
It's like nearly 60,000 workers.
I think even, at least there's 115,000 workers, and about 60,000 are in those two unions. The big issue is really no longer money. That has been, they have agreed more or less on raises for the railway workers. But the biggest issue is basically working conditions. They have the workers on hold for several days at a time. They work 12-hour shifts with little notice, and they are penalized for calling in sick. You cannot go to see a doctor, even unpaid. There's no, first of all, there's no paid sick leave. There's not even no unpaid sick leave without getting fired. And 99% of the participating members of the Locomotive Engineers Union voted in July to authorize a strike. So they're, I mean, they're at least pretty darn close to the full 115,000 are going to go on strike.
How is like that kind of sick leave or these kind of benefits not federally mandated given like the railways
sweetheart deal that they have on all these? I mean,
it's just insane.
It's insane. But it also should be, you know, you could have Trump come in and or DeSantis and reverse that. What you need is just they need to come to a deal. There have been multiple times where apparently the industry has tried, has claimed that the union will not go to mediation, and they went to the National Labor Relations Board, and the National Labor Relations Board reviewed those claims and booted them. So it really comes to how much will the Labor Department, how much will Joe Biden lean on these, and I don't know what he could bring to bear in terms of like actual material implications for these carriers. And incidentally, the carriers reported record income from their operations last year, some of the large freight carriers. So this is not a, you know, this again is really just about controlling labor in many respects. So we will give you an update on that. If you have stuff that is absolutely essential to you, like if you are someone who has medication or other things that could potentially be disrupted by a large disruption in the supply chain, you may want to stock up on stuff.
Growing up in North Dakota, the one sort of unionized industry that where I was aware of like what a unionized worker was the rail workers. And I mowed lawns for a guy who was the best paying guy I mowed lawns for, who worked for the railroad all his life and had a really good wages and retirement benefits.
Yeah, those retirement benefits are probably gone now.
In terms of like what, just a pension? That's probably.
Yeah, well, I mean, at one point in this country, during the Reagan years in particular, it started. We moved from a defined benefit pensions, which means that you are guaranteed to get X number of dollars per month in retirement, to a defined contribution program, which means that you are you must, your inputs into that pension fund are fixed, but your outputs aren't. And often what happened, they started to loosen up some of the regulations on pensions. They introduced the idea of a 401k, which has been an experimental disaster. It has been just a disaster in terms of like people's ability to save this money over the long term when they have control over it.
But hey, it funneled more money into the stock market as opposed to pension plans that would guarantee certain payouts for retired people.
It certainly expanded the sort of like where people were going to pay for these things. Now, what a company would do is they would take this money and they would invest it. Sometimes, you know, part of it was certainly in the equities, but probably largely in more fixed rate things, so they could really determine and make sure that they were going to get the returns that they anticipate. But a lot of them, things started loosening up. And when you don't have a defined benefit, the company basically says, like, well, we can play loose and fast with this because we're not guaranteeing you any types of return. We make, you know, some of the we can make some of the slush funds on this. We can make, some, you know, so we'll invest, or maybe we won't invest everything, or we'll just assume that the rate of return is going to be higher than it actually ends up being. We need to bring back those pensions, or really, I mean, you know, I don't know how we would mandate that other than just we need to expand Social Security.
It's also just like such a perfect metaphor or encapsulation for what workers' rights have become over the past 40 years, is like the onus is on you more so than it is on your employer.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And the idea was like, oh, and if we get rid of these defined benefit pensions, people are more inclined to put more money into the stock market. And then you'll get all that sort of what they call dumb money on Wall Street.
A dignified retirement brought to you by speculation instead of just guaranteeing it to people.
And hey, if that 401k kind of didn't grow or isn't paying out in the same way, maybe you'd be smart to invest in an IRA as well,
or
right?
Some crypto.
Yeah.
And an IRA is entirely on you. It's just, it's sick.
Let's, speaking of sick, we should also say that, you know, one of the things that's going to incentivize Biden to really lean on these freight railway companies is inflation topped forecasts this month. It was presumed that it would be flat relative to July. Again, year over year, we're at about 8% plus. But in July, inflation had basically stopped growing. It had plateaued. It was anticipated the same thing would happen in August because gas prices have gone down. But simultaneously, you have the Fed raising interest rates, which has cooled the housing market, which has you have less houses coming online in terms of new construction because people are having trouble selling their existing homes. And rents are going up. Food also went up, apparently, and medical care has gone up, in part because you still have 65,000, I think a net deficit of 65,000 nurses, primarily, who have left the business because it is so crappy. Some, 14,000 or 15,000, are on strike in Minnesota because basically the same reasons why the nurses in Worcester went on strike. They are being asked to do too much because of the profit motive of the owners, the private owners of these hospitals. And so you're having nurses who are overworked. They are being required to care for too many patients. They are worried about the health of the patients. They are getting paid too little for the work that they're doing. And 3 days out, that's it. They'll be back in a couple of days. They're being paid. They're apparently the hospitals are paying traveling nurses to cover. But we'll see. We'll see where that ends up. Let's talk about Lindsey Graham introducing an abortion ban proposal that is ostensibly supposed to make the Republicans, there's two messages you can take from this, but this is supposedly to make the Republicans seem more reasonable when it comes to abortion.
And get out ahead of it, right? Get out ahead of just the narrative. That's what they're trying to do.
Well, they're afraid of what abortion is doing to their electoral chances in November.
It's a little late to get out ahead of it, but it makes it seem like, hey, we're reasonable, right? But, or that's what their thinking is. And I was concerned when I saw it, but because, like, I thought maybe the media would frame it as, hey, you know, they're trying to find a middle ground on abortion with this 15-week ban. But every headline I'm seeing is calling it a ban, which is good.
Because, I mean, look, here's the bottom line. 90% of abortions are performed, I think, in the first 13 weeks. The issue is largely about the other 10%. And a 15-week abortion ban means that you will have women dying. The story in the Times today, coincidentally, I don't think that people understood that Graham was going to try this yesterday, about the medical impact of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. In Texas, in the New York Times, oncologists say they now wait for pregnant women with cancer to get sicker before they treat them because the standard of care would be to abort the fetus rather than allow treatments that damage it. But state law allows abortions only at risk of death. They literally have to play around with cancer patients being at risk for death. There is no world in which that is better for cancer patients. Some hospitals have established committees to evaluate whether a pregnancy complication is severe enough to justify an abortion. There's a task force in Arizona set up. In Wisconsin, a group of doctors and lawyers is trying to come up with guidelines on how to comply with the newly revived 173-year-old law that prohibits abortion except to save the life of a pregnant woman. If you have preeclampsia, which is it's a complication of pregnancy. It's where blood pressure can drop, or protein in the urine, high blood pressure. Blood pressure raises. It can be hard to distinguish from normal pregnancy. It calls for an abortion, but if you see that this is happens after 20 weeks, these are the people who are at risk. Ectopic pregnancies, these are the people who are at risk. Miscarriages, these are the people who are at risk. And this whole notion of exceptions, the Republicans are still deluding themselves as to what the implications of these abortion bans are. And before anyone writes in about France or Germany or any European countries having 15 week is their cutoff, note that when they say exceptions, the exceptions are driven by the determination of the pregnant woman. If the pregnant woman feels that this is in any way a jeopardy to her health, the abortion is okay. There is no liability. There is no, responsibility by the doctors to make that assessment in a way that would scare them. They're afraid to go to jail.
Well, I mean, and has there even been any, like, actual discussion about what this process would be, about a determination of whether or not the exception would be valid in this instance? And I'd imagine there'd be some, like, legal wrangling and finagling by these states, right? That's basically like, They were talking about this in the Obama era, the death panels. That's kind of what it is, right?
Yes, except for the death panels are basically saying, you know, what we're going to pay for in terms of care. It's not outlawing any care.
No, I know. I'm just saying it was their caricature of the death panels, is going to the government and making a determination about, like, what medical choice you can make for yourself.
Course. Without a doubt.
And it's going to be these just, you know, insanely conservative state governments.
An obstetrician in Scottsdale, Arizona, Julie Quatra, was quoted as saying the confusion around when you can abort in the context of a threat to the life of the mother. And again, this doesn't even, like, deal with the idea of How long does it take you to prove that you've been raped in a court of law?
The idea that we can even prove rapes in this country, it's one of the cases that are pursued the least, and it's because of, well, misogyny and also difficulty.
Quatra says this was eminently predictable, given the number of situations where physicians have to terminate pregnancies to protect the health or life of a pregnant woman. But even she was surprised at the number and range of hospital employees who have emerged with concerns. Forensic nurses who care for sexual assault victims in the emergency room said they would no longer provide morning after contraception for fear it would be considered an abortion drug. Because the old law punishes those who aid and abet an abortion, an anesthesiologist worried that he might be prosecuted for putting a patient to sleep for an abortion. A neonatologist worried about liability for declining to resuscitate a fetus judged no longer viable. She said, we already work under a cloud of getting sued. That's what we signed up for. This is different. This is criminal liability, not civil liability. This is jail time. Jeez. You think you have a shortage of medical personnel now? Another story of patients showing up at a hospital in Texas with a stillborn fetus. The required procedure was induced delivery, not abortion, but still doctors declined to do it. And an alert had to go out to find a physician who was willing. The doctor said patients with conditions that don't even fall under the ban are being denied care.
Yeah. Hey, if you have a miscarriage and you have a fetus that's dead inside of you, it's probably your fault, right? You're not being the perfect vessel for life.
Let me get in touch with my lawyers, see if I can help you.
Exactly.
I mean, people have made this point, and it's really easy, but I think it's important to hammer home, like, this whole Lindsey Graham and Republican effort to codify this federally, which it's not going to go anywhere under Biden, but it's a preview if a Republican wins. States' rights. They were saying this is all about states' rights. States should make the determination about whether or not they should allow abortion in their state. And like it's people should pay attention because it's instructive for them historically and then in the future when Republicans are making these arguments. States' rights, as they say it, are a fig leaf for stripping people of their civil rights and of their individual rights. And they do it, like, within the same few months. It doesn't take them that long. So that's what this is.
And you can be sure that a Republican-sponsored 15-week ban on abortions is going to allow for states to actually ban it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
This is just going to be the sort of outer bounds. And again, this is also the bill they're raising now when they know it can't pass. This is exclusively to attempt to say that we are moderate in terms of our perception of whether abortion should be legal or not. I guarantee you the bill that they bring up when they control the Senate and the House and the presidency will not allow for 15 weeks. Again, let me just remind you, this is in Germany. There is supposedly a ban after 12 weeks. But exceptions include when, quote, from the pregnant person's point of view, that's a quote, abortion is, quote, necessary to avert a danger to the life or grave injury to the mental or physical health of the pregnant person, taking into account her present and future living conditions. In other words, take it seriously. You choose. That's it.
Easy.
So when that person who says France or Germany to you says France or Germany to you about this as being reasonable, you can cite that. That came from a piece that Don Moynihan wrote on his, I guess it was a Medium post. maybe we can put a link to that, debunking the false comparisons between European and American abortion policies. Because this is going to be part of the talking point. But make no mistake about it. What Lindsey Graham is proposing is an abortion ban. And all of the dangers that are associated with that, in terms of women's health, are wrapped up in that ban. And I think, I think from a perspective of a political perspective, one, it's really telling because they realize that abortion is a huge issue in this election.
Oh, yeah.
And two, they realize that they're really, you know, marginal, and it gives a hint as to where they're going to go with this. And I'll tell you, this also really, I mean, contemplate this. If the Democrats pick up two seats in the Senate, if they can hold the House, by no means is this something that you should bank on. They really, at that point, only need 51 votes in the Senate to carve out a filibuster exception. You heard Fetterman announce that he was going to do this. He had 3,000 people at a rally in a Republican part of Pennsylvania in the rain. And was talking about overturning passing protection for abortion on a federal level. Democrats, they do this, then the Republicans have to run against repealing the right for people to have an abortion. They are terrified of this issue because they are slowly, some of them, are starting to realize like how bat crap crazy this policy is. And how much people take offense to having their rights rolled back after 50 years.
Just look at the voter registration rolls in the aforementioned Pennsylvania and in Wisconsin. And look at how many women are registering right now. This is going to translate. I mean, is it enough to hold the House? I don't know, but keep messaging on it, at least from an electoral perspective, Democrats.
Well, without a doubt. They're going to run hard on this, and this is going to help them. All right, one last thing I want to get to, and we'll head into the fun half. And then in the fun half, we'll be talking to Mike Duncan, host of the Revolutions podcast, author of The Hero of Two Worlds, The Marquis de Lafayette, and The Age of Revolution. I know I don't have to say it that way, but I can't help it.
I went to Lafayette College, and there was like a sword that they introduced into the graduation ceremony that we were like, oh, this must be Marquis de Lafayette's sword. And no, it wasn't. There's like no connection to it anyway.
But they just wanted a sword?
Yeah, it was really dumb. Yeah.
I don't get
it. It's not really, it's kind of a dumb school. No offense.
Want to put this on your radar. We're going to hopefully have a guest on this soon. There is a case coming out of Indiana that has been taken up by the Supreme Court. It is Talevsky versus Health and Hospital Corporation of Marion County. This is in Indiana. This is one of those cases where the Supreme Court could very narrowly decide this case, or they could do with what they did on Citizens United and what they did on Dobbs, which is to go beyond the scope of what the plaintiff was interested in, at least initially, and answer a much broader question that nobody really has asked, but will allow them to undermine essentially the rights of individuals who are in any way touched by a federal program. So this is a... this is a case about Medicaid. It had to do with this guy, Talevsky, who is now dead, Talevsky, and it's being continued on by his family. He was in a nursing home paid for by Medicaid. Medicaid pays for 2/3 of the people who are in nursing homes. It's paid by Medicaid. The Federal Nursing Home Reform Act give nursing home residents the right to be free from restraint, whether physical or chemical. The family, Telvisky's family, sued the HHC, which is the Health and Hospital Corporation, with the claim that they violated his rights under the Federal Nursing Home Reform Act by giving him all sorts of chemical restraints and medicine that basically, rather than treating his dementia-related problems. The and then HHC sort of expanded in their brief what they're seeking from the court as the defendant. They are asking the Supreme Court to rule that individuals may no longer sue to protect their rights under the spending clause statutes and under Medicaid Nursing Home Reform Act under the section 1983. 1983 allows individuals to sue state governments and I guess municipal governments, I guess presumably also counties, I guess, for and their employees. So, you know, and they're supposedly indemnified by the state and the localities. If their civil rights have been violated, 1983 doesn't give them civil rights. It just provides the mechanism in which to enforce these civil rights. And the civil rights are given to them by the spending clause, which allows Congress to tax and the Constitution tax and spend, essentially. And when they do spend in programs like Medicare, Medicaid, SNAP, SCHIP, temporary assistance to needy families, I mean, there are more. The federal government essentially gives them certain rights under those programs. And really, the only way the federal government, because these programs are administered by the state, the only way the federal government has to enforce the way that these programs are executed, in other words, if you're on Medicaid, you get dental care. But if a state says we're no longer giving people dental care, a dental patient could sue the state. Under 1983, the clause, and say, like, my civil rights are being violated because Medicaid has been, Congress has required the Medicaid covered dental, and you're not doing it. The details, you have some wiggle room, but I need dental, and Medicaid is supposed to do that.
And that this is particularly important given the Republican state's reluctance to, and reluctance is kind of a weak word for it, to make these programs. I mean, we saw this under Obama too. They just like didn't take the federal money that was provided for them for Medicaid expansion. Their reluctance to make these programs work for their citizenry.
Absolutely. They would rather spend it essentially on tax cuts. And the only recourse that the federal government would have without this 1983 section allowing for these type of lawsuits would be to end the program for the state, to cut them off totally. And a lot of these states, like Emma said, they wouldn't even take the expansion of Medicaid.
They'd be like, nice, great.
If they don't care about the people who are living between 120% and, let's say, 400% of poverty, or 100% of poverty and 133% of poverty, they don't care about the people living at 90% of poverty. They'll cut these programs. They're fine to let them go. They're not available. The federal government cuts them off. They're fine. And the Supreme Court could essentially just blow a huge hole in the ability of Congress to send money with strings, essentially. We will follow that. We'll talk to an expert on that coming up. We're going to head into the fun half of the program, and we'll be talking to Mike Duncan. He is the host of the Revolutions podcast, author of A Hero of Two Worlds, The Marquis de Lafayette, The Age of Revolution. We don't have him yet, right? Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only help the show survive and thrive, but you also get the free half, free commercials. You get the fun half. You get our undying appreciation. I should also say, like, you know, periodically I say this. We appreciate the super chats. We do. We don't do the shout out to the super chats. I know that is not best practices. We just don't do it. We just don't do it. But we do appreciate it. We do note it. Much appreciated. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Check out the AM Quickie, amquickie.com. You sign up. What? You get the top news stories from a left perspective in your email box every morning. Corey and Jack do a great job with that. Hustle up. Check it out. Also, the Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Become a member of our Discord. We have over 6,000 people in that Discord as well. Great place for resources and whatnot. And today, following the spectacular debut of ESVN, episode number 2.
Yes.
Live today.
Live today at 4 p.m. We're going to be recapping week 1 of the NFL, in which my Giants won in an upset against the Tennessee Titans. I wore blue for that reason. But there was also a lot of interesting storylines. I want to go through which quarterbacks would you take over Russell Wilson with Bradley, given the result of last night's game. We'll also be talking about the Cowboys implosion in week 1. The Steelers stealing one against the Bengals, and if the Bills and Chiefs are just like light years ahead of every other team in the NFL right now.
I drafted Dak Prescott above Tom Brady and another old quarterback, and I'm regretting that.
I took Matthew Stafford, and he had a terrible performance because I usually wait on quarterbacks. But yeah, we'll be talking about that. And I do want to say, I think we are going to move till Monday. I think we're going to move to Monday because Tuesdays are a little packed, and also I just think, like, if we're kind of centering the star of the show on the NFL season, you know, Sunday, doing it after Sunday might be better, and the Monday night game we can get to at another date, because maybe we'll do a little bit of Bradley and my picks on Thursdays. We'll see.
And are you going to take calls today?
I will take calls today.
All right,
yes.
So go over there and slam the comments with your thoughts about Mondays and all the other stuff, too.
Yeah.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekien media universe?
Left Reckoning tonight, 8 Eastern, and Left Reckoning YouTube. We're going to talk about the Minnesota nurses strike. Also, Aaron Kleinman is going to give us a little bit of an overview of certain state legislature races and stuff like that that people need to keep an eye on this election season, and some other fun stuff.
All right. And, you know, two questions on the IM, and then we're going to take a break and head into the fun half. One is, Sam, can you explain how legally states can tax student loan forgiveness? It is an income. How is this possible? Baffled. It is considered, it could be, loan forgiveness is generally considered, income. But under the American Recovery Act, the COVID relief bill that the Democrats passed in February of last year, they said until 2025, any student loan forgiveness would not be considered income for the purposes of taxes. States could attempt to tax on it. I'm not sure of the legal intricacies between the fact that it was a federal subsidy as opposed to, you know, something else, but that's the theory anyways. Generally, if you have a loan forgiven, you are receiving some value, and that value can be taxed. Lastly, Subway Doug, I don't understand why Graham would propose this now. Doesn't this just reinforce the idea that Republicans want a national ban? Why wouldn't they just wait till after the election? Doesn't this hurt them? I am of the mind that it does. I think Graham thought it would be a way to show that we're moderate, but the dude should pick up a poll, because 15-week bans are now incredibly unpopular because people realize the agenda of the Republican Party is driven by religious fundamentalists. And they're not going to stop. They're not going to stop at a 15-week ban. They're not going to stop at a 6-week ban. They're not going to stop. And they're not going to stop with abortion. They're going to go for contraception. This is, they believe it is not your purview to determine whether you are forced to carry a pregnancy to term. It is not up to you. It is up to God as mediated through them.
It's good that they put some craven weirdo bachelor on the job, though, in Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He may be the only Republican senator not to have paid for an abortion. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll head into the fun half. 646-257-3920 is the number. But first, in the fun half, we're going to be talking to Mike Duncan, host of the Revolutions podcast, author of Hero of Two Worlds, The Marquis de Lafayette in the Age of Revolution. I think it's pretty obvious I like saying that. All right, we'll be right back. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Unpacked. Matt.
Boo.
Unpacked.
What is up, everyone?
Unpacked. Nomi Key.
You did it.
Unpacked.
Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Unpacked. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though. Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.